Listening test.
Part 1.
You will hear an interview with a marketing director. First, you have some time to look at questions.
Continuing our theme of business marketing, I have with me today Mr. Brian Kinsella, who is here to talk about the differences between marketing a product and marketing a service.
Good morning. Now, I understand that many of you here today are interested in a career in services marketing. Well, I've been the marketing director for Oceania Travel for nearly 11 years, so I feel that I can present what I consider to be the most important aspects of marketing a service. However, before I begin, I want to clarify what I mean by services marketing. This not only means aspects like holiday destinations, but also professional services such as legal advice. In short, anyone that sells a service. Actually, a lot of the traditional services such as lawyers, accountants, etc., have not felt too comfortable marketing their services. It's almost perceived in industries such as these that the need to market indicates a weakness in the services provided. However, more and more such industries are realizing the importance of marketing to sustain their customer numbers, especially when their competitors are marketing themselves. Now, the main difference between marketing a product and a service is that the customers cannot understand exactly what the service will be. They can see a product and can comprehend exactly what the product will do for them. A service is more intangible. By that, I mean whatever each customer gains from the service is often very personal. For example, with a travel agency, clients choose to travel abroad for a multitude of motives. Some people travel overseas for the experience and really want to get to know the culture of the local people. Others wish to escape from reality, totally relax in sophisticated comfort, and be waited on hand and foot. Obviously, our clients will not be judging what we offer by the same standards, and travel agents, like other such service industries, have an extremely difficult job in satisfying a range of customers from diverse backgrounds with different expectations. Our company has overcome this dilemma in a number of ways. First of all, our travel consultants are given extensive training in customer service and buyer behavior. Our aim is not just to be a profit-making organization, but also to meet and exceed the expectations or dreams of our clients. Our mission statement, in fact, is primarily to offer a service which is above and beyond the hopes of our clients. In addition, we regularly visit the tourist destinations we promote and inform all of our staff about any changes in specific areas. Not only is it important to be fully informed about every possible aspect of the service you are marketing, it is also essential to constantly improve the service offered. At Oceania Travel, we regularly conduct surveys with all of the people that visit our resorts of choice. Any negative feedback we try to remedy at once. Our clients are met by a company representative during their stay, and we have a set procedure for dealing with any complaints. Our clients are not expected to have to approach the hotel reception, as we have a 24-hour contact service director, our representatives, and this representative should always welcome any customer problems or questions. In the event of a complaint, the representative will then try to remedy the complaint with the hotel. If the problem cannot be rectified by the hotel manager, our representative is authorized to remedy the situation him or herself. For situations beyond the representative's authority, our complaints department is contacted. The complaints department guarantees a solution within the day. If the customer is still not satisfied, they are welcome to approach our head office on their return. So you see that marketing a service is catering more for the client's expectations than anything else, and it is that which makes services marketing a very intricate business. Now that's the end of my presentation, but if there is anything you want to ask, then please feel free to do so. Thank you.
Now listen again.
Continuing our theme of business marketing, I have with me today Mr. Brian Kinsella, who is here to talk about the differences between marketing a product and marketing a service.
Good morning. Now, I understand that many of you here today are interested in a career in services marketing. Well, I've been the marketing director for Oceania Travel for nearly 11 years, so I feel that I can present what I consider to be the most important aspects of marketing a service. However, before I begin, I want to clarify what I mean by services marketing. This not only means aspects like holiday destinations, but also professional services such as legal advice. In short, anyone that sells a service. Actually, a lot of the traditional services such as lawyers, accountants, etc., have not felt too comfortable marketing their services. It's almost perceived in industries such as these that the need to market indicates a weakness in the services provided. However, more and more such industries are realizing the importance of marketing to sustain their customer numbers, especially when their competitors are marketing themselves. Now, the main difference between marketing a product and a service is that the customers cannot understand exactly what the service will be. They can see a product and can comprehend exactly what the product will do for them. A service is more intangible. By that, I mean whatever each customer gains from the service is often very personal. For example, with a travel agency, clients choose to travel abroad for a multitude of motives. Some people travel overseas for the experience and really want to get to know the culture of the local people. Others wish to escape from reality, totally relax in sophisticated comfort, and be waited on hand and foot. Obviously, our clients will not be judging what we offer by the same standards, and travel agents, like other such service industries, have an extremely difficult job in satisfying a range of customers from diverse backgrounds with different expectations. Our company has overcome this dilemma in a number of ways. First of all, our travel consultants are given extensive training in customer service and buyer behavior. Our aim is not just to be a profit-making organization, but also to meet and exceed the expectations or dreams of our clients. Our mission statement, in fact, is primarily to offer a service which is above and beyond the hopes of our clients. In addition, we regularly visit the tourist destinations we promote and inform all of our staff about any changes in specific areas. Not only is it important to be fully informed about every possible aspect of the service you are marketing, it is also essential to constantly improve the service offered. At Oceania Travel, we regularly conduct surveys with all of the people that visit our resorts of choice. Any negative feedback we try to remedy at once. Our clients are met by a company representative during their stay, and we have a set procedure for dealing with any complaints. Our clients are not expected to have to approach the hotel reception, as we have a 24-hour contact service direct to our representatives, and this representative should always welcome any customer problems or questions. In the event of a complaint, the representative will then try to remedy the complaint with the hotel. If the problem cannot be rectified by the hotel manager, our representative is authorized to remedy the situation him or herself. For situations beyond the representative's authority, our complaints department is contacted. The complaints department guarantees a solution within the day. If the customer is still not satisfied, they are welcome to approach our head office on their return. So you see that marketing a service is catering more for the client's expectations than anything else, and it is that which makes services marketing a very intricate business. Now that's the end of my presentation. But if there is anything you want to ask, then please feel free to do so. Thank you.
That is the end of part one. Now turn to part two.
Multiple matching.
Speaker one.
I never had time to go to the German classes my company arranged for us at work, so I used to put tapes on in the car on the way in every morning, and just let the language wash over me. I was completely immersed in it for the whole journey. Then I'd listen to the same section on the way home, and that was enough to ensure I learnt what I'd heard in the morning. When I go to Germany on sales trips now, I have very few problems understanding people. Business seems to be improving too.
Speaker 2.
I went to Spain twice when I was studying languages at university, once on holiday and the next year to work in a bar. The holiday was a disaster in terms of language learning. I spent most of the time with my English friends and hardly learnt a thing. When I went back there to work, though, I spoke Spanish all day and my speaking and understanding really improved. That experience working abroad helped me pass my final exams just as much as studying, I'm convinced. Oh, and I'm getting married this year to my Spanish girlfriend.
Speaker 3.
I spent 3 years teaching English in Poland with my boyfriend back in the early 90s. It took us both quite a long time to learn any Polish in the beginning, partly because of laziness, but mostly because we were working long hours teaching and speaking English all day. Things got better, though, once we eventually got to know a few Polish people and we had more chance to speak the language. We both became much more integrated after that. We even saw a few films in Polish at the cinema.
Speaker 4.
Here in Wales, everyone can speak English, but more and more young people are learning Welsh, the real native language. My mum and dad both came to Wales from England, so I only ever spoke in English till I came to this school. But all lessons are in Welsh, see? Right from day one, everything has been in Welsh, and I've learned really quickly. So now I've got the two languages. I speak in Welsh with my friends, and I speak it at home too with my brother. It's great, because we can talk about things in front of my mum and dad, and they've got no idea what either of us is saying. Really useful sometimes.
Speaker 5.
When I left university, I desperately wanted to work abroad, but all three French-owned companies that I applied to turned me down at the interview stage. I'd only ever learnt grammar when I was at school, so when I had to speak French in the interview, I couldn't understand the questions, and I'm sure the interviewers couldn't understand a word of what I was saying. So I signed up for a 2-month course in Paris, and when I came back, I got the first job I applied for.
Now you will hear part two again.
Speaker 1.
I never had time to go to the German classes my company arranged for us at work, so I used to put tapes on in the car on the way in every morning and just let the language wash over me. I was completely immersed in it for the whole journey. Then I'd listen to the same section on the way home, and that was enough to ensure I learnt what I'd heard in the morning. When I go to Germany on sales trips now, I have very few problems understanding people. Business seems to be improving too.
Speaker 2.
I went to Spain twice when I was studying languages at university, once on holiday and the next year to work in a bar. The holiday was a disaster in terms of language learning. I spent most of the time with my English friends and hardly learnt a thing. When I went back there to work, though, I spoke Spanish all day, and my speaking and understanding really improved. That experience working abroad helped me pass my final exams just as much as studying, I'm convinced. Oh, and I'm getting married this year to my Spanish girlfriend.
Speaker 3.
I spent 3 years teaching English in Poland with my boyfriend back in the early 90s. It took us both quite a long time to learn any Polish in the beginning, partly because of laziness, but mostly because we were working long hours teaching and speaking English all day. Things got better, though, once we eventually got to know a few Polish people and we had more chance to speak the language. We both became much more integrated after that. We even saw a few films in Polish at the cinema.
Speaker 4.
Here in Wales, everyone can speak English, but more and more young people are learning Welsh, the real native language. My mum and dad both came to Wales from England, so I only ever spoke in English till I came to this school. But all lessons are in Welsh, see? Right from day one, everything has been in Welsh, and I've learned really quickly. So now I've got the two languages. I speak in Welsh with my friends, and I speak it at home too with my brother. It's great, because we can talk about things in front of my mum and dad, and they've got no idea what either of us is saying. Really useful sometimes.
Speaker 5.
When I left university, I desperately wanted to work abroad, but all three French-owned companies that I applied to turned me down at the interview stage. I'd only ever learnt grammar when I was at school, so when I had to speak French in the interview, I couldn't understand the questions, and I'm sure the interviewers couldn't understand a word of what I was saying. So I signed up for a 2-month course in Paris, and when I came back, I got the first job I applied for.
That is the end of part 2. Now turn to part 3.
You will hear part of an interview with a young artist called Linda Buckland, who is talking about her life and work. Choose the answer A, B, C, or D, which fits best according to what you hear.
Now, many of you will have seen and admired Linda Buckland's striking drawings of the River Thames in London, which were featured in a recent edition of a leading monthly magazine. Linda joins me today to talk about her work. Linda, hello.
Hi.
Why the river? Where did it all start?
Well, I feel energised by drawing a living, breathing thing. And when I'm drawing down by the river, I much prefer it when there's something going on. A ship's docking or the cranes are moving. It's easier to feel involved, part of the action. My paintings are all about life and movement. As far as themes are concerned, I'm not interested in landscapes as such.
And they have a wide appeal, don't they? Because we can all place them. We know where we are with them.
Well, maybe that's because I'm actually quite resistant to the idea of moving into abstract art, because that's what everyone kind of expects you to do. And the resistance stems, I think, from where I did my training. I was at a college where there was a very strong emphasis on figure drawing and traditional drawing skills generally. It would be hard to shake that off, even if I wanted to.
So do you actually do the drawings down by the waterfront?
Not much of the work is done in situ, actually. Just the preliminary sketches. Those then act as my source of inspiration. I take them home and work on them and play about with them until I get an idea of how a finished drawing might look. The drawings often take the form of composite images, actually.
So your workspace is pretty important to you.
It's funny you should mention that, because when I did those particular drawings, I was working in a rented studio in South London. It was a great space with a nice atmosphere. It was big enough to have 6 or 7 pieces of work on the go at the same time. But it was beginning to get me down, because although it wasn't that far away in terms of miles, it was a stressful journey to get over there. I often found that ideas that were fresh in my mind as I left the house in the morning were draining away by the time I'd fought my way through the traffic.
So where do you work now?
Well, as I say, I'd had it in mind for some time to find a workspace closer to home. And then one day earlier this year, I noticed an easel in an upstairs window in one of the houses on the other side of the road where I live. I knew the girl across the road was an artist, but for some reason I thought she was a designer working in a potter's studio or something. I'd never met her to talk to, so it was a pleasant surprise to realise not only did I have a painter living nearby, but she also did her work there too.
A real coincidence.
Amazing! I was seeing the easel standing there was one of those eureka moments, you know. I phoned her later on and said that I had a show coming up and could I rent a room on a short-term basis. As it turned out, she was happy for me to take over a room as a temporary studio.
So it's really worked out well for you.
I've only been in this studio for a couple of months, but it's already proved to be a revelation. And there's the obvious benefit of just having to cross the road to get there. And at first I was concerned about whether I'd be able to completely detach myself mentally from the normal day-to-day routine, which is vital. I know I'd be terribly distracted if I actually tried to work at home.
So tell us about the exhibition.
Well, the work I'll be showing at the exhibition in September is all new work, a lot of it produced in my present studio. Working there has had a real impact on my work. I think it's got a lot to do with the fact that I can come in and work in short bursts. One of the effects of that has been that the work has been developing more quickly, and I think the images are sharper as a result. But it's not only that. The colours have changed, become softer, though I couldn't tell you why. Overall, I think the effect is a much stronger image.
And what does the future hold?
Although I've started to experiment with different surfaces and mediums...
Now you will hear part three again.
Now, many of you will have seen and admired Linda Buckland's striking drawings of the River Thames in London, which were featured in a recent edition of a leading monthly magazine. Linda joins me today to talk about her work. Linda, hello.
Hi.
Why the river? Where did it all start?
Well, I feel energised by drawing a living, breathing thing. When I'm drawing down by the river, I much prefer it when there's something going on. A ship's docking or the cranes are moving. It's easier to feel involved, part of the action. My paintings are all about life and movement. As far as themes are concerned, I'm not interested in landscapes as such.
And they have a wide appeal, don't they? Because we can all place them. We know where we are with them.
Well, maybe that's because I'm actually quite resistant to the idea of moving into abstract art, because that's what everyone kind of expects you to do. And the resistance stems, I think, from where I did my training. I was at a college where there was a very strong emphasis on figure drawing and traditional drawing skills generally. It'd be hard to shake that off, even if I wanted to.
So do you actually do the drawings down by the waterfront?
Not much of the work is done in situ, actually. Just the preliminary sketches. Those then act as my source of inspiration. I take them home and work on them and play about with them until I get an idea of how a finished drawing might look. The drawings often take the form of composite images, actually.
So your workspace is pretty important to you.
It's funny you should mention that, because when I did those particular drawings, I was working in a rented studio in South London. It was a great space with a nice atmosphere. It was big enough to have 6 or 7 pieces of work on the go at the same time. But it was beginning to get me down, because although it wasn't that far away in terms of miles, it was a stressful journey to get over there. I often found that ideas that were fresh in my mind as I left the house in the morning were draining away by the time I'd fought my way through the traffic.
So where do you work now?
Well, as I say, I'd had it in mind for some time to find a workspace closer to home. And then one day earlier this year, I noticed an easel in an upstairs window in one of the houses on the other side of the road where I live. I knew the girl across the road was an artist, but for some reason I thought she was a designer working in a potter's studio or something. I'd never met her to talk to, so it was a pleasant surprise to realise not only did I have a painter living nearby, but she also did her work there too.
A real coincidence.
Amazing! I was seeing the easel standing there was one of those eureka moments, you know. I phoned her later on and said that I had a show coming up and could I rent a room on a short-term basis. As it turned out, she was happy for me to take over a room as a temporary studio.
So it's really worked out well for you.
I've only been in this studio for a couple of months, but it's already proved to be a revelation. And there's the obvious benefit of just having to cross the road to get there. And at first I was concerned about whether I'd be able to completely detach myself mentally from the normal day-to-day routine, which is vital. I know I'd be terribly distracted if I actually tried to work at home.
So tell us about the exhibition.
Well, the work I'll be showing at the exhibition in September is all new work, a lot of it produced in my present studio. Working there has had a real impact on my work. I think it's got a lot to do with the fact that I can come in and work in short bursts. One of the effects of that has been that the work has been developing more quickly, and I think the images are sharper as a result. But it's not only that. The colours have changed, become softer, though I couldn't tell you why. Overall, I think the effect is a much stronger image.
And what does the future hold?
Although I've started to experiment with different surfaces and mediums...
That is the end of the test. Please stop now.